हरे कृष्णा, गुड इवनिंग फ्रेंड्स, वेलकम टू हिज होलीनेस राधानाथ महाराज टू आवर होम. वी आर सो ग्रेटफुल टू यू महाराज. माय फ्रेंड्स हियर, दे आर वेरी स्पेशल फॉर मी. मेनी ऑफ देम आर वेरी बिजी, एक्सट्रीमली बिजी एग्जीक्यूटिव्स. द मोमेंट आई टोल्ड देम राधानाथ महाराज इज कमिंग आवर होम, दे एक्सेप्टेड माई इन्विटेशन. आई एम सो ग्रेटफुल टू देम. आई एम सो ग्रेटफुल टू यू महाराज. Vivek asked me, Vivek Paranspe is advisor to Mukesh Ambani, chairman of Reliance Industries. So he asked me, what is this about? Vivek had gone for Pandharpur Jatra recently, last Jatra. So he asked me, what is this about? So I told him, we have an opportunity to meet somebody. Actually, spontaneously I said, what should I say? I said, somebody like Vivek, somebody like Tukaram, Namdev, Gyaneshwar, you can actually meet in person. That's what I told spontaneously. I didn't know how else to introduce Maharaj. Maharaj, I'm not entitled to introduce Maharaj to all of you. Maharaj, every word, every speech, as you listen to him, as you experience, as you read his book, you will know what Maharaj is. I don't want to speak anything about Maharaj. I will personally hand over journey home to each of you. And I'll be very happy and grateful if you read that book. I don't want to speak much about Maharaj. And I don't want to come in the way between his blessings, his address to us and you all. Maharaj, there are very, very special senior executives. Prabodh is there. Mr. M.K. Singh is there. They are very highly accomplished businessmen and corporate leaders. So they have come with great enthusiasm and interest to listen to you and to be blessed by you. Thank you, Maharaj, for coming. Thank you, my friends. I'm so grateful to all of you. Hare Krishna.
Very grateful to be with all of you this evening. Special gratitude to Vijay and Gitanjali for opening the doors of their beautiful home for all of us. And thank you so much for each of you taking your very precious time to be with us. The most precious thing we have in life is each moment. How we utilize these moments and for what purpose is so much what determines not only the quality of our life, but what we can achieve in life. This is the universal question that has been asked from the very beginning of time and before. What is the greatest purpose that I can achieve in my life? We do not know how long we live. Padam padam yad vipadam natesham. In this world, at any moment, changes could come about. But while we are here, what is that purpose? And for each and every one of us, we have so many purposes. We have our occupational purposes, our domestic purposes, our family purposes, our social purposes, our entertainment purposes, our health purposes. And there's also a spiritual purpose. And how we make our priorities and how we balance all of these different aspects of our life is what will determine, to a very large extent, the quality of our life. Shakespeare said, if you lose your money, you lose nothing. If you lose your health, you lose something. But if you lose your character, your integrity, then you lose everything. The Brahma Sutra tells us, anandamayo byashat, that every living being is seeking pleasure. The little insect, the cockroach, the ant, our dogs or cats, every type of human being from every nationality, from every caste, from every race, from every religion, everyone is looking for pleasure. And according to our consciousness and how we have been conditioned, we have different ways of finding that pleasure. And why do we make so many arrangements to avoid pain? Because it interrupts pleasure. And why is it that every living being has this in common? This quest for fulfillment. According to the Gita, it's because it's our inherent nature. The living force within every living being is by constitutional position, Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge, and full of bliss, full of happiness. But when we forget our constitutional nature, what is within ourselves, and when we forget our relationship with that which is beyond this ever-changing world, then we seek that pleasure in things. Things can give satisfaction to the mind to some extent. Things could give satisfaction to the senses to some extent. But the only experience that gives pleasure to the heart is to feel love and to give love. Special effects. If we have everything in the world, but we have no one to love and no one who loves us, our heart is empty. Because it is that love that is true pleasure. And the need for that, the hunger for that, is our inherent essence. And all the great spiritual traditions throughout time are teaching us that Bhagavan, or God, who we call Krishna, his many names, is the ultimate object of all love. And when we connect to that love that is natural within us, not only do we find the experience of his infinite love, but then we become an instrument of that love in whatever we do. In the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna was a warrior. That's the least likely occupation to love, is it not? And when you're a warrior in Kurukshetra like Arjuna, you can't be lazy. He was really busy. At every moment, if he wasn't totally alert, totally focused, he would be finished. So he was performing his duty with meticulous, determined enthusiasm. But he was doing it in a spirit of compassion, as an instrument of God's love. And Duryodhana, he was an instrument of his own envy, his own greed. They were both doing the same thing, but the result was very different. So how we choose to utilize our time is so important. I remember when I was young, as a teenager, growing up in America, I had serious questions. Vijay and Gitanjali asked me to speak on this book that I wrote, so in honor of their wish. To explain the scenario briefly, there was a country where every day in school we pledged allegiance to the United States flag. And within that little pledge that we would speak, it was one nation, individual, under God, with liberty and justice for all. But in the 1950s, if your color was dark, the African Americans, there wasn't many Asians in those days, then you were condemned to live and die in the ghetto. There was hardly 5% people in those ghettos that could ever get out. There was not equal opportunity in education. There was not equal opportunity in jobs. There wasn't equal opportunity of where you could buy a house or live. This troubled me. It seemed like a contradiction. At the same time, there was a war in Vietnam, and if you turn 18, you have three choices if you're a man. Either you go to war and fight and kill or be killed, or you go to jail. The third choice, you secretly escape from America. You cross the border and hide. And many of us didn't believe that that war was worth fighting, worth dying for. And when some of the young generation demonstrated by questioning the validity of this war, I was one. We were beaten by clubs, tear gassed, sometimes imprisoned by the police, who we were told were protecting our freedom. It was a contradiction. At the same time, I was seeing around me a lot of wealth, a lot of prosperity, people gaining tremendous power. But I really didn't see that they had a meaningful, a fulfilling, or a purposeful life. Nor did I see that they were really happy. Their happiness was a thin veneer. So as a teenager, I was questioning, what do I want in life? And somehow or other, I wanted to see how people of other countries view life, society, God. And I wanted to see how other people in other countries viewed America. I was taught that America was a subjugated country being exploited by the British, and we fought a war against them, and we got freedom. I believed in that. But then I went to England, and I asked them, what do you learn in school about this? That you people were just a bunch of savages, and we were trying to give you culture and education and society that's based on real principles, but you just fought against us like animals, and ultimately we gave it to you. Well, that's very different views of history. Anyways, as time was going on, I heard the words of Gandhi. Gandhi said that we should be the change we want to see in this world. And I witnessed of the people who were like me, it was called the counterculture, we had the same problems, the same issues as the people we were demonstrating against. Just different clothes, different language, and different ideas. So I came to the experience in my own life that this change has to come from within ourselves. It's a spiritual change. So I began to study various spiritual paths through books, through literature. And as I was traveling through Europe, hitchhiking, I didn't have money. I was with one friend. I was 19 at that time. We were going to synagogues to study Judaism, going to cathedrals to study Christianity. Eventually, it's a long story, we ended up in a cave living in an island of Greece. And I was praying for direction on the top of a mountain, all alone. My friend, he was doing his prayer on this oceanside. And every evening after sunset, we would share our experiences. One day, I was literally crying for direction. And I heard a voice. And I knew if I follow what this voice said, my life would never be the same. It was the loudest voice I ever heard in my life, but it was completely silent. Came from within. Three words. Go to India. At that time in my life, I had never met an Indian. I had never eaten Indian food. Never tasted a chili pepper. I didn't know where India was. I didn't have a map. And I had no money to buy a map. But I was determined to go. I went back to the cave. I climbed down the mountain where my friend was. And I said, something incredible happened to me today. He said, something incredible happened to me. I said, what? He said, you won't believe me. I said, I will believe you. He said, no, you won't believe me. I said, tell me. He said, I heard a voice. I said, what did he say? He said, you won't believe me. No, I will believe you. What did he say? He said, go to Israel. I said, Israel? Where? He said, I told you you wouldn't believe. No, I believe you, but I didn't hear you. Where? He said, Israel. We should go to Israel together. I said, Gary, he told me to go to India. India? The next morning at sunrise, I left the cave and started my journey to India. I was hitchhiking. Do you all know what hitchhiking is? You go like this. Recently, I was giving a lecture at the University of London, this SOAS, and they asked me to tell the story. And afterward, one girl came up to me, maybe 21 years old, very lively girl. And she said that I really liked your story because I am the president of the United Kingdom Hitchhikers Association. And I want to follow the same path that you took, from London through Europe, through the Middle East to India, through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. And I want to bring a group. I wanted your guidance. I said, my guidance is that you should take your group and hitchhike to the Heathrow Airport. And then take a plane, because you can't do this anymore. It was difficult enough when I did. I went through Turkey, then Iran, then Afghanistan. It took 6 months to reach the Indian border. But I'll just share a few stories that really had an effect in my life. I was in a place called Kandahar, Afghanistan. And they were the poorest people I've ever seen. They were very friendly. And somebody invited me to a little tea stall. It was just a shack with a dirt floor, and it fit about 10 people. They were all crouched, squatted down on the floor, on the ground, just drinking this tea. They gave me some tea. And then this boy, he may have been 15 or 16 years old, he came in. He was so poor. He was literally in rags and emaciated, thin. He was obviously totally illiterate. But what affected me the most was his eyes. He was blind, and there was nothing covering his eyes. They were swollen, they were discolored, they were deformed. I had never seen anything like this. In America, people don't appear like this publicly. He had a stick, just a branch of a tree, with a rusty can at one end, and there was a wire nailed from that end to the other end. It was a musical instrument. He started playing. It wasn't like the guitars that I grew up with. That one string, he went boom, 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 boom. He started singing these beautiful prayers in song form to his God. And as he was singing, it was night, he literally lit up the room. He had hardly any teeth. He was so happy. And the five or six of us sitting, we were mesmerized. It was about 40 minutes that he was singing. And I remember thinking, I have never seen anyone in my life so happy as this boy. Now, this was serious culture shock for me. Because my whole life I was brought up to think, if you have health, if you have education, if you have money, if you have influence, you'll be happy. And I met so many people with all that. And this person looked like the happiest person I ever seen. He had nothing. But there was something within he was experiencing, and something within that he was joyfully sharing with us. What is happiness? This question was burning even hotter in my heart at this point. And hitchhiking again across the Middle East, there was many near-death experiences. A lot of people didn't like a foreigner like me. A lot of diseases I was getting. Finally, I reached the Indian border. I had such anticipation. The land of the Himalayas, the land of the river Ganga, the land of the sages and the rishis and the lamas that I have read about, the land that I've sacrificed, risked my life to reach. I finally am here. It was just steps away. I gave my passport and my valid visa to the immigration agent. She just had a table in a forest in Ferozpur, Punjab. She looked at it. She looked at me. She asked the one question that I prayed she wouldn't ask. How much money do you have? I looked through my little cloth bag because everything I had was stolen in Afghanistan and other places when I was running for my life from certain situations. I had 26 cents in about 5 currencies. She pounded her fist against the table and said, "You are rejected. You must show me $200 to enter India. We have enough beggars here. We don't want another one." I pleaded. I gave up the comforts and the wealth of my country in America, seeking the treasures of your culture, your spirituality, your people. Please, give me a chance. And the more I pleaded, the angrier she became. And because I wouldn't go back, she had the security guards put their rifles in my face and say, "Go back or we will shoot you." Where was I going to go? I was in a no man's land between Pakistan and India. I only had a one-way visa to Pakistan, so I couldn't go back there. There were no telephones. There were no emails. There was no way to communicate with anyone in the world. I remember asking God. I wasn't so sure who this God was, but I believed he heard me. "Why have you led me all this way and now I can't get in?" 6 hours, I kept going back to the guard and kept getting rejected. Finally, there was a change of guard just around sunset, and a very tall Sikh gentleman, elderly man, he took the post, and the previous guard pointed at me and said, "Don't let him in." And he said, "I will never let him." She drove off in a jeep. And I approached him, and he looked at me like, "Don't approach me. I know about you." And I handed him my passport, and he wouldn't even take it. I said, "Please let me in." He said, "I have been warned by my superior officer about you. You are rejected." I started to cry. They were real tears. I said, I've given everything up for this. I want to understand the real wealth of the culture of your great nation. Just give me a chance. He gazed in my eyes with such intense inspection. For about a minute, no word said. Then he said, I am going to, even though my superior officer ordered me to reject you, I am going to give you the chance that you're crying for. He said, sometimes a man just must follow his heart. I said, if you just give me this chance, I promise someday I will do something good for your people. And he took my passport and stamped it. He put his hand on my head and said, son, may you find what you are crying for. Welcome to India. I was alone. By this time it was dark. The Husainawala border post near Firozpur. I was walking. I lost the road. I was just walking through agricultural fields. I didn't know if I should go right or left. I didn't even know what going forward was. But I was practically embracing every star and every leaf and every tree because for the first time in my life, I really felt at home. I knew no one. I had nothing. It was a mystical experience. Eventually, I went to the Himalayas. And while there, I lived in some of the caves. One Kailash Baba, who was a sadhu, maybe about 70 years old, he taught me how to live in caves and how to get food in the forest. You know, what leaves and what herbs were good for us. He taught me how to live among leopards and snakes, scorpions and wild elephants. He taught me that if you fear them, or if you feel yourself superior to them, they will kill you. But if you honor and respect the living force within them, they will accept you as their neighbor. He's been living in this forest for 60 years, traveling the Himalayas. Now, I went to college for some time, and I studied courses, but this was a crash course. Because as he's telling me this, there's snakes, there's leopards. We're sleeping, going to sleep at night, and they're walking around. He said, you cannot fear them, and you cannot judge them by thinking you're better. You have to honor them as God's children, then they will never harm you. And you know, in his company, I was fearless. His conviction empowered me. And he taught me something else, how to mix with other sadhus of different sects. And that is more difficult than living with the animals and the snakes. Very sensitive situation. And what was incredible, I lived with him for some time. He taught me so much, and he didn't speak any English, and I didn't speak Hindi. But because he cared about me so deeply, and I really wanted to learn, everything he wanted to relate to me, I could understand. And that was a special lesson. That care, concern, and love is a most powerful way of communicating, even beyond language. I stayed on the bank of the Ganga and went in a rock in the middle of the Ganga and sat on that rock from sunrise to sunset every day for about a month. And for that whole month, I don't think I spoke to a single human being because I was in a secluded place. I was trying to go deeper. And there's not time for details, but it's written in this book, the incredible lessons I got in life just by studying Mother Ganga. The first day I arrived in the Himalayas, I was sitting on the bank of the Ganges. And no one was around, but one sadhu walked up to me. Never saw him before. He said, "You don't know me, but I know you." This sounded quite mysterious. I was attracted to that. I just didn't say anything. He said, "Take off your Western clothes and offer them to the Ganga, and I will give you the robes of a sadhu." I said, "What's a sadhu?" He said, "It's a homeless person wandering the world seeking the truth." So that kind of sounded what I wanted to do. But I only had one set of clothes, because everything else I lost. And when you only have one set of clothes, it's part of your identity. I didn't realize how attached I was to those clothes. When you're about to lose something, you really understand how much it means to you. That's the same with people sometimes. So I threw my jeans in the Ganga. Then I threw my turtleneck shirt in the Ganga. I was standing there in my underpants. And he said, "Offer Ganga your underpants." Now, this is becoming a serious act of surrender. I was thinking, they're made in India in 19, this is in 1970, 42 years back. I was thinking that there may not be another pair of underpants for 10,000 miles. And he gave me this kopan, this loincloth, and showed me how to put it on and wrapped a cloth around my waist, and then I offered my underpants. And he gave me just two sheets of cloth. One he wrapped around my waist as a lungi and one as a chadar. And then he said to me, "The Ganga will become your mother. This you will understand." And he left. And I never saw him again. The lessons I learned in the Ganga about life, more than anything I ever learned in school even, changed my life. If we're open, if we're receptive, it's incredible how God could speak to us. Even through nature, even through the most ordinary situations that we see every day. I'll tell you one very dramatic experience that happened to me. I was going higher in Himalayas. From Rishikesh, I was going toward Devprayag. And I came into a clearance in a jungle. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. the most suffering people I could imagine. Some were naked, some were in rags, in the cold. Some of them were just had holes in the ground with dirt over them to keep warm. Many had no fingers, no toes, no nose. It was a leprosy colony. When these lepers saw me, they were so desperate. It was in the middle of nowhere. Somehow I just walked into it. They made a tight circle around me so I couldn't move. And with desperate eyes, they were screaming, "Bakshish, bakshish." They wanted money. I didn't have a single paisa, but they didn't believe me. A foreigner with no money, that was unacceptable to them. They were screaming, "Bakshish, bakshish," and wouldn't let me move an inch for about 20 minutes. Finally, with their hands, they searched me. And I remember thinking, why are they doing this to me? But then I was thinking, they're so desperate and so totally forsaken by the rest of society that anything they do is justified. And then I was thinking, because I didn't know anything about leprosy except that it was contagious. You know, they're spitting on me, they're touching me, their blood is on me. Will I become like them? Finally, after they searched every part of me and saw I had no money, they let me go. It was a great relief. I took a few steps and saw to my left there was a very old leper woman. No fingers, no toes, no nose, hardly any hair, in rags. She looked like she was in her 80s. She was just kind of laying there. And she somehow or other sat up. And in her eyes, I saw that she really felt for me. I could see in her eyes that what her people did to me, she felt so sorrowful. She was looking at me with compassion, like a mother. I saw in her eyes what touched my heart is here is a lady, all she wants in life is for someone to accept the motherly love that's within her heart, that nobody she could give it to. And just the fact that I was looking at her, she felt so much fulfillment. She offered her pranams, and then she offered her hand to bless me. And that affection, that motherly affection that she embodied, affected me so much that I ran over to her, got on my knees, and put my head under her hand. And she was rubbing my head. And in Hindi, over and over again, she was saying, "May God bless you, my child. May God bless you, my child." And I looked up. And I saw this deformed face. It was decomposing. The bones were not right. Her eyes were misshapen. The leprosy had made her so deformed. But she was crying. She was crying in joy. The joy of a mother blessing a child. She had a huge smile on her face as she was saying, "May God bless you, my child." There were no teeth. Do you know why this was such a transforming experience for me? Because while I looked up at her, I was thinking, she is the most beautiful person I've ever seen in my life. Now, as a child, I used to see all the Hollywood movies, Marilyn Monroe and all, Sophia Loren and all these beautiful women, but no one compared to this. Because her beauty wasn't in her flesh. Her beauty was in her love, in her will to love. I walked away after thanking her, and I went to the Ganga, and I saw the ripples and the swirls of the surface of the Ganga, and I was thinking, the current beneath it is constant. Although on the surface everything's always changing. And what's really important in life? Who we really are and what our real aspirations are, or just the externals that people become so attached to in this world? Met many yogis, many gurus, many sadhus, lamas, studied under them. I went to Calcutta and Bodh Gaya and Varanasi and Sarnath, many places in Himalayas. I lived with Mother Teresa for some time in Calcutta. I was trying to get an understanding. Eventually I came to Mumbai. This was in 1971. I was taking a meditation course. This time I was just a barefoot sadhu with long matted hair. I hadn't shaved in a couple years. But my face didn't look much different than now, because I wanted to grow a beard like the other sadhus, but nothing came out. I was walking down the street here in South Mumbai, just for walking. I had no place to go. So I was sitting in meditation for about 10 days. So I wanted to walk. And I saw a big sign advertising a spiritual festival. When I went there, there was a big tent. It was in Cross Maidan. And in the evening, over 20,000 people gathered. And I was sitting way, way, way in the back. And there were some people doing kirtan on the stage. And then the guru came. And he just looked so humble, but at the same time so powerful. So gentle and so graceful, but with such confidence. But I could hardly see him because I was so far away. And I was thinking, I wish I could be closer. But I didn't feel it was right to go in front of anyone else, so I just sat there. And then I saw him call somebody and talk to him. And that person who he spoke to was going like this in the crowd. And no one came. So he came down in the crowd or went through this entire sea of people, came all the way to the back, walked right up to me and said, "My guru wants you to sit with him on the stage." I asked, "How does he know me?" He didn't answer my question. He just took my hand and pulled me. And I was very pullable in those days. So he pulled me through the crowds and I onto the stage. This very gracious, saintly person welcomed me and offered me to sit. He couldn't speak because there was a kirtan and it was very loud. So I sat just about this far away. And as he was speaking, my heart was saying, "This is your guru." But my mind was thinking, "You've already met so many gurus and so many enlightened beings. How could you make such a decision?" So my mind said no and rejected what my heart was saying. So he invited me to sit on stage with him, and I did for about 14 days every morning and evening during his classes. And then I went back to the Himalayas. It was much later in Vrindavan that I actually accepted him as my guru. But from them I left. And I went back to Himalayas. I was traveling and I needed to get visas, new visas, extensions. And I was told I had to go to Nepal. So I remember, many stories are coming to mind, but I'll just tell a few. I remember there's a place in Nepal called Bodhanath. I remember sitting there thinking about that friend of mine who went to Israel, Gary. I was wondering where Gary could be. He was my lifelong friend. From 10 years old, we grew up together. But I thought, I'll probably never see him again. And I was just sitting in a little forest. And here's another lesson I learned. I saw this gigantic, muscular German tourist with a big bag of groceries. He was walking through the forest. He was probably at least 6'5", and he was obviously a bodybuilder athlete. He was huge. And I was just a skinny little sadhu sitting under a tree, wondering, what's he doing here? And he made a lot of noise when he was walking. He was like, boom, boom, boom. And I'm looking, okay. And all of a sudden, a gang of monkeys, little brown monkeys, not the big white ones, the little brown monkeys, they made a circle around him and started showing their teeth. And he was scared. And they were coming closer and closer. They wanted that bag of groceries. He picked up this gigantic rock and started howling, "Rah!" and twirling and threatening to throw the rock at the monkeys. And the monkeys just came closer and closer. I saw that big Hercules-type man drop the rock. And he was trembling with fear. And one of the monkeys just walked right up to him, took the bag out of his hand, and walked away. And he stood there like this. And all the monkeys gathered around the bag to get stuff from it. And he like ran away because they were busy eating his food. I was thinking, these little monkeys, how'd they do that? But that's just the beginning of the story. Then I saw this little Nepalese boy. He was about 6 years old. He saw the monkeys with this bag of food that they were eating. They just started. And he picked up a little stone and went running to the monkeys. And all the monkeys went, "Ear, ear, ear," and all ran, scattered in all directions to get away. And he picked up the bag and walked away with it. I was thinking, what just happened? That little boy did not weigh as much as one arm of that European. Why were the monkeys scared of this little boy and they weren't scared of him? He was holding a rock this big. He had a little stone this big. I was trying to make a psychological analysis of why did that happen. And he was sitting there eating the food, and all the monkeys were watching from a distance. And I understood that that European man, he had physical strength that the monkeys couldn't compare to, but they sensed fear in him. Because obviously he didn't live with monkeys so much in Germany. They sensed fear. And that little Nepalese boy, he had no fear. Because he had no fear, they feared him. Very powerful lesson. The nature of fear. When people sense fear, you're vulnerable. And the monkeys were expert at exploiting that vulnerability. One of the greatest powers of life is to be fearless in whatever we do. And one of the greatest impediments is fear on every level. Then I was tested. The little boy saw me sitting under the tree watching. And he came up to me and took out of the bag a bundle of bananas and offered them to me. As soon as he went to give me the bananas, all the monkeys were going, they were getting really excited. And I told him, he didn't speak English, I just said, no, I don't want bananas. I realized that they sensed fear in me. So they were very excited that they were going to get those bananas. So I said, you keep the bananas. Another day I traveled up to Swayambhunath, and it was the monsoon rain season. And I just decided to take a walk. I was living at this under a tree near the monkey temple on a mountain. And I just walked about 3-4 kilometers, and then I was coming back through rice paddies. And then, you know, rice paddies during the monsoon, they're really thick with mud and water. And there's just those little borders that you could walk on. So I was walking on the border, and I saw massive dark clouds forming in the sky, and I heard thunder, and I saw lightning, and I realized there was going to be a massive storm. So I looked for shelter. But in that rice paddy, there was no trees. There was no buildings. To every horizon, there was only paddies. But a distance away, I saw what looked like one old man. He was the only other human as far as the eyes could see. And he was carrying an umbrella. I decided, I'm going to get under that umbrella. So I was running. You know, those borders of rice paddies and the wet, you know, you're slipping. But I somehow ran behind him and went right up against him under his umbrella. As the rain was pouring on the umbrella. We walked about 15, 20 minutes. He never looked back, I guess because he was wondering, who is this stranger? And also, it's hard to turn around when you're on a little border. And finally, it stopped raining. And I was going the wrong direction. So I thanked him. And for the first time, this person turned around. And he dropped the umbrella right in the mud. He looked at me. He screamed. And I looked at him. And I screamed. It was Gary, my friend, who I left in that cave in the Isle of Crete a year ago. And we had no communication whatsoever. We were walking as the only two human beings in this entire massive rice paddy under the same umbrella. And we just recognized each other. Gary happens to be visiting India now. If you don't believe this story, you could ask him. But I taught him how to hitchhike the way sadhus do. Back in those days, you jump through the window of a third-class train. And by the time you get in, it's so crowded, no ticket collectors could fit. So it's free. That's what the sadhus taught me. So we were going through this train, and there was a massive storm. And the train was stuck in this field somewhere in Uttar Pradesh. We were going to Kashmir, to Amarnath, because there was a pilgrimage there. I was taking my friend from, we took trains to Varanasi, and from Varanasi we were going to closer to Amarnath. The train was in one place in this field that was flooded for about 20 hours. There was no seats, there was no food, there was no water. The air was highly recycled by all these humans packed in. And finally, after over a day of just sitting in one place, and it was very hot, something about human nature is stagnancy is so irritating. Just moving was like mukti, it was like liberation. We're moving, we're actually moving. And the train stopped at 5 a.m. in the pitch dark at the first station for so long, and we were thinking, let's go out and get some water and breathe some air and move, and then we'll jump back into the train. So we did that, and the train started moving, and we tried to get back in, but it was so crowded, we couldn't get in. The train was gone. We had no idea where we were. After some time, the people who couldn't get in the train left the platform. The people who came off the train left the platform, and we were kind of alone. Gary said to me, "Now what?" I said, I don't know. So I asked somebody, "Where are we?" There was a sadhu sitting with a little fire on the platform. And I said, "Where are we?" And he stood up and said, "This is Mathura, Krishna's birthplace. And today is Janmashtami, Krishna's birthday. Let me take you to Krishna's birthplace." So I went. And it's a long story. It was very crowded. A day or two later, Gary wanted to go to the Himalayas, and I said, "I'll meet you at Haridwar, and then we'll go to Amarnath." I told him, "This under this clock at Brahmagat, we will meet at this time on this day." And I was sleeping on the bank of the Yamuna River. And the morning I was supposed to leave, I couldn't move. I had typhoid fever. And by the time I got better, I just loved that place so much. And the concept of bhakti, unconditional love, applying this spirit of seva, or selfless service, to whatever we do, whether we're kings or sadhus, whether we're in business, whether we're in politics, whether we're farmers, whatever we may do, yat karoshi yat ashnasi yat juhoshi tadasi yat yat tapasyasi kondiya tat kurushu madharapana. If we do it in a spirit of devotion, we can attain the supreme perfection. This so much satisfied my heart. And about 6 months later, Prabhupada came there, and I understood where I wanted to go. Now I'm going to fast forward to last year. This was all happening 1970-71. I get invited to many different places to speak. And there's one man, his name is Mike Milken. He's a very prominent investor in the United States. And he has every year the Milken Global Conference. And very, very top CEOs, presidents of universities, of corporations, powerful people in sports and politics and in entertainment, they come there. And I think it's like 4,000 people come. They rent out the whole Beverly Hills Hotel every year. And there's different presentations. So somehow I met him, and he had me give some lectures to his dearest friends. And then he invited me to give lectures every morning at his global conference. I think I was the first spiritual person he ever invited for that. So I was giving, he wanted me to give morning meditations with a nice little lecture and message for these people. So one day, you know, he very much insisted that I come to one presentation in the big ballroom of the hotel. And it was a presentation on true leadership. And there was a panel of 5 people. Are you interested in this story? It was... Now, I'm a Swami, but I was very affected by this. One was someone named Steve Wynn. Is that his name? He owns, I think he's the biggest casino and hotel owner in the world. He owns the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas and all these places. Another was the CEO and president of Safeway Foods, one of the largest grocery markets in America. Another was the CEO president of a pharmaceutical research company that found more cures for cancer than anyone else in history, I think. And Mike Milken was there as the moderator. And the other person was one of the 5 most successful baseball managers in history. You all know baseball? Okay. What interested me, a few things, is they're talking about true leadership. These are all American people, very top-rated American people. And I counted 5 times they quoted Mahatma Gandhi. And the conclusion of the whole session was they put words of Mahatma Gandhi on this very computerized board that they were using. And Mike Milken, he's a statistical person. He had these statistics, which years and years of research. He was explaining how he had a graph. I don't remember the specifics of the graph, but I'll tell you the general principle. that if a person is not paid enough to have a comfortable life, then you don't get their full potential of performance. You have to give them enough, and he had the numbers there, so that they're actually not worried about the little things in life. They feel secure and comfortable. And when you give them that much, he showed, the performance of the person goes up dramatically. But then according to the graph, any amount of money you give him more than that, or her, any amount more, there's no increase in the person's performance. If you give them hundreds and thousands of dollars more, there's no increase in the performance. But according to the graph, if you make them feel valued, if you make them feel that their contribution is really important, if you really deeply make them feel appreciated, it goes way, way up. And these are top business people. I'm a little Swami, that's what I teach. I was thinking, this is fascinating. That affection, appreciation is so powerful. Beyond the comfort zone, more powerful even than money as a motivator. And he asked each of these panelists what the most meaningful thing they've ever done in life is. And before he asked the question, he gave the highlights of these people's lives. And he went to Joe Torre, who was a manager of the New York Yankees. And he wrote how the New York Yankees were in the biggest slump they ever had. They hadn't gotten into a World Series for 10 years. So the owner, he hired Joe Torre to be their manager. Now, Joe Torre was a Hall of Fame baseball player. He was a great player, but he wasn't people didn't think he was a good manager. So the New York press was just blasting against the Yankees. They were calling Joe Torre the worst names. They were saying he's useless, he's going to ruin this team, he has no capabilities, and they were just television, he was just being slaughtered. But he took the job. And in the next 10 years that he was manager, they were in 6 World Series and he won 4 World Series. And he was one of the 5 greatest managers in baseball history. So Mike Milken said, what is the most fulfilling accomplishment you did in your life? And he just kind of looked down. And he said, compared to this lady next to me who cures people of cancer, I've never done anything. Now, there were 3,000 people in this room. It was a beautiful banquet room with tables, and everyone was eating their dinners, and I was drinking water. It was kind of vegetarian, because Mike Milken's a vegetarian, actually. But we were sitting there, and he said, and Mike Milken said, you may say this, but he said, how many people out there are New York Yankee fans? Probably about 2,000 people raised their hands. He said, we think you've done a lot of things that are very significant. What was most fulfilling? And he had tears in his eyes. He started telling his life story. He said, when I was a little boy, I suffered so bad. My father was an alcoholic, and he was so abusive to my mother, and so abusive to our children. He said, as a little boy, I lived in fear. going home was like torture. To hear screaming, to hear yelling, to see fighting, to be beat up. He said, it was terrible. I suffered so bad. He said, I lived in New York. He said, the only relief I had in my life was I would go out and play baseball. It wasn't just playing. When I played, I was all of my frustrations, all of my anxieties, I was releasing in baseball. And by getting absorbed in baseball, I was forgetting the sufferings of home. He said, that's why I became such a great baseball player. That's why I'm in the Hall of Fame. He said, the most fulfilling thing I ever did in my life was not winning World Series, was not entering the Hall of Fame, was not becoming the most popular man in New York City, which he was. He said, I started a foundation of helping children from abusive homes. And we put counselors, and we put psychologists, and we put all sorts of support systems in different schools of New York where children are suffering the same way I did. And we help them to get through it. He said, when I see these little children who come in totally afraid, he said, they felt like I was. That we are totally worthless. We're not worth anything in this world. He said, there's nothing more painful than feeling like that. When I see them smile, because we can make them see their potential, see their value, he said, that is the greatest fulfillment of my life, more than any other accomplishment. After he said that, the only time in this whole session, he got a standing ovation, and I saw practically everybody there. There was presidents of countries, presidents of universities, presidents of corporations. There was governors of states. They were all sitting there. I saw tears in their eyes as they were clapping. Because he was genuine. He touched their hearts. And after the standing ovation, you know what he said? He said, I have to tell you, this whole foundation was all my wife's idea. It wasn't my idea. I'm just trying to assist her. That was quite revolutionary. He didn't even take credit for that. And that gave him even more satisfaction. So a Swami who's focused on spiritual ideals, why was I so inspired by that? Because it's human nature. In the deepest instincts of our hearts, compassion is what brings the greatest fulfillment, the greatest satisfaction. And is actually the highest purpose of our life, more than all the other things we can ever do. And he was able to do what he did because he was so famous. And he did have so much wealth, and he did have so much influence. But he used it for a purpose of compassion. In other words, he was an instrument of love. And that's what spirituality is meant to do on the deepest level, to connect us with that love. We call Krishna the supreme source of everything that exists, the all-beautiful person. To connect with that love and to be an instrument of that love is where the deepest purpose, meaning, and fulfillment can be found. In everyone. It's not a sectarian concept. These are a few lessons. Now I'm going to tell one more short story. Can you imagine my poor parents when I was on this journey? Their 19-year-old son. He was going for a summer vacation between college semesters to Europe, promised to be back in 2.5 months, and never came home. My father and mother, they worried so much. They were very traditional, caring Jewish parents. My father was a businessman who worked very hard, very well connected. They would get letters from me. Well, they didn't hear from me for about a month after I was supposed to come home. Then they got this little letter. It was an aerogram saying, I'm no longer with Gary. I decided to find an understanding of how people of the East see the world. So I'm hitchhiking to India. Please do not worry about me. There was no return address. Every now and then he'd get a letter from me saying I'm living in a cave in jungles of Himalayas. I thought he would be proud of me, my mother. But they thought I was insane. They were so worried. But I knew in my heart, I just had this feeling that because I'm doing this for a higher purpose, to serve God and humanity, in the end, they will be proud. It took some years, but my father's in Bombay now. He's 89 years old. When my mother passed away, because they had come to India several times just to meet the people here, to see what we were doing here. When my mother passed away, she told the family, something that never was done in any of our generations, to cremate her. Jews don't do this. Cremate my body and ask Radhanath Swami to bring my ashes to India. And the whole family, oh, yes, this is what we want. So proud, so happy. And when I put her ashes in the Ganga, there were 3,000 devotees chanting prayers. And I was thinking, how beautiful. The mother of my physical body is now merging into Mother Ganga, one of my most holy spiritual mothers. And with tears in my eyes, I offered a little prayer. Mother Ganga, please bring my mother to the sea of Krishna's grace. And I remember standing there watching her ashes in the current, thinking, this is bhakti, to harmonize the material with the spiritual, to harmonize our talents, to harmonize our whatever we may have with the very nature of our hearts, the nature of our souls. Thank you very much. Would anyone like to ask any questions? give any comments or anything? Yes, please.
Meeting Gary, as a spiritual person, how would you attribute to? Is it a miracle? Gary holding the umbrella and you are meeting in no man's land. You can't even imagine. How do you attribute this phenomenon?
It's impossible for me to believe it was a coincidence. We were best of friends from 10 years old. We went on so many journeys together, and at a certain point we separated because my yearning for spirituality had become so intense and he just couldn't follow that. So he went west and I went east. How we were both together in that rice paddy, I believe it was a divine arrangement. I believe it was the grace of God. And that's just one little story of, if you read The Journey Home, the dynamics of what happens with Gary and I, that's just one part. It's actually quite incredible. I remember after Gary called my name and I called his name under that umbrella, the first thing Gary said, "No one will ever believe this." But most everybody does believe it. Because the nature of the world, if we really go deep into any aspect of this world, everything is unbelievable. How we're born is unbelievable. You know, the father and the mother come together and a little seed is transferred from the father's into the mother, and that little seed, what is the size of that seed? What does it look like? And somehow or other, just by the emulsification of the ovum and the semen, that little seed starts to grow. And it grows limbs and senses and eyes and ears and tongue and nose, and a little brain starts forming, and hearts and livers and lungs and kidneys and pancreases. How is all that happening? You know, we can say from a genetics perspective, you know, how it's working, but incredible orchestration. Is there an intelligence behind it, or is all happening by accident? It's unbelievable. Every person we see, how they were born, is an unbelievable thing. Every tree, from a banyan tree, little seed falls. Who can understand that there's a recently, I was in the Muir Woods in California where there's these redwood trees, the biggest trees in the world, the sequoia. And I'm looking at these little seeds, thinking, in the little seed this big, there's a sequoia tree this big. I was at one sequoia tree, it's called the President Grant tree in Kings Canyon. And I did some research about that tree. If 40 adults held their hands, they could go around the base of the tree. 39 couldn't do it. You know what basketballs are? If you hollowed out that tree, you could fit 170,000 basketballs or 2.2 million table tennis balls. And if you put petrol in that empty, in that hollowed out trunk of the tree, you could drive around the world over 2 times without filling up for gas. It's a huge tree. And right next to it's a little seed. I'm thinking, one of these trees is in that, this tree was inside of a seed this big. It's unbelievable. And I was thinking of Bombay during the monsoons. You know those big clouds? Usually once a year there's a downpour that floods the city. The airports are closed, the railways are closed, the buses are closed. I remember where our temple is in K.M. Munshi Marg in Chopati. One time I would look during the monsoons, it was so flooded that people with rowboats were going down the street, because no cars could go. And all that water is stored in a cloud. And the cloud is so light, it's floating in the sky. It has all that water in it and floating in the sky. You know, why doesn't it just fall down and crush us all? There's quadrillions of gallons of water there. Now, to buy trucks to bring that much water in, how many tankers would it take? But that water, it's just in the sky, and a little breeze is moving it all. There are scientific explanations. But, you know, how and why it's doing, it's actually unbelievable. Everything we see in this world is unbelievable. But the question is, are our hearts and eyes open to see the beauty and the miracles of the world around us? Or are we just so caught up that we just see everything as ordinary? You know, the spiritual path is to be perceptive of the miraculous grace that's really all around us and within us. And this chanting of God's names, this mantra, it cleanses the mind from all of the envy and greed and selfish lust and arrogance, that just because all of these, and illusion and anger, all of these things are like dust in a mirror. They prevent us from seeing who we really are and understanding what we really want. But if our heart is cleansed from this obsessive egoism, then we can actually, it doesn't make us less productive. Which is a more powerful force, greed or love? A mother's love, she'll do anything for her child. She'll struggle 24 hours a day without sleep. She's not getting paid for it, but she loves her child. When we clean our heart of all of these anartas, all of these unwanted pollutions, then we could see the real love that's within us, the beauty within us. And then we can actually, once we see it within us, we can see that beauty within others, within nature. And we could be an instrument. And then, yes, you know, we can, some of the most great productive, I mean, Gandhi, he worked hard. But he was doing it out of compassion. My guru, Srila Prabhupada, at 70 years old, he went on a cargo ship, suffering heart attacks, seasickness, had no money, arrived in New York City after 38 days, and gave his life and soul out of love for people. So yes, you know, to be dynamic, to be productive, to be creative, to utilize our full potential in what we do, but to be motivated by compassion is where not only we can do great things, but we could give something that's most critically needed in the world. That's an example. And that's where that satisfaction could come. So meeting Gary in that rice paddy under that umbrella and walking with him without even knowing either one of us who we were for a half hour, it was just one of those little beautiful miracles of life that are actually all around us. I hope that answers your question. Is there any other questions? Wonderful to be with you. Thank you for so patiently listening to me. And Gitanjali, Vijay, such beautiful friends you have. I'm so honored you allowed me to be a part of this. Thank you.